Isaac Newton gave us the laws of gravity, celestial mechanics, and calculus. Reclusive and secretive, Newton presents a challenge to a biographer. Despite his eminence, he was a loner. Behind closed doors, he was an alchemist who often tasted his alchemical concoctions. Award-winning science writer James Gleick has put together a life of Isaac Newton that captures some of the genius and complexity of the man. Gleick told Steve Paulson it's important to remember that boundaries weren't as clear in the 17th century.
There was no clear line for him between the different areas of his interest. It was all the same. No one was saying, this is physics, this is mathematics, this is alchemy, this is theology. He was trying to understand everything about nature that he could understand. And he was doing it in a very hands-on way.
And I suppose one other way of looking at it is maybe Isaac Newton just lived in a world that believed in magic more, certainly in religion more. I mean, it was a highly religious society that he lived in, a highly spiritual society as compared to our secular age today.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And it's one of the things that most struck me about this project when I was getting started, how medieval the world seemed compared to the way we think about it, I think. I mean, when we see movies, historical movies about the 17th century, people, okay, they wear funny costumes, but they seem to be more or less modern. They weren't modern. Newton grew up in a remote farmhouse where he was the first male of his family ever to be able to read or write. His father was an illiterate farmer who died before he was born. There was no such thing as a book anywhere in the household. And he really had to start from scratch. As you say, it was a world very much ruled by magic still.
So he was part of that world. I mean, he wasn't just rejecting that. He was, in a sense, trying to make sense of it. He was trying to find order, underlying order in it. And for him, that meant both science and God and trying to figure out how the two work together.
Definitely. He certainly never stopped believing in God. And he never, even though the science that he has bequeathed us seems to be purely rational and free of mysticism and magic, it wasn't free of mysticism for him. When you think about it, even the notion of gravitation is a mystical thing because it's not mechanical. It's not one object banging against another object. You have to imagine an invisible, mysterious force. And he had to admit that the thing he was proposing couldn't be seen. You could only infer it from the mathematics. And that made it very unpopular with European scientists, for example, who thought that he was trying to revert to a kind of magic in inventing gravity.
So was that Newton's greatest achievement to explain gravity?
I think his greatest achievement was not gravity in itself or any other single thing. He would be one of the greatest scientists who ever lived if he had just explained gravity, or if he had explained the nature of light as he did, or invented the calculus. If you had to say what his greatest achievement was, I think it would be something deeper than that. It would be in showing us that you can explain things throughout the universe in terms of a few simple laws and in terms of a mathematical framework that ties them all together.
You mentioned earlier that there was some kind of a mental breakdown in Newton's life. What do we know about that?
We know a little bit, but not a lot. It happened at least once at the pinnacle of his career when he was 50 years old, and he had by then published his great work and was alone living in London. And all we know is, well, he was out of sorts. There were rumors spreading about him. There were even people who thought maybe he had died. He was said to be very sick. He wrote some letters to a couple of his acquaintances, including John Locke and Samuel Pepys, the famous diarist, in which he was almost incoherent, or he described retroactively a kind of incoherence. He accused Locke of trying to embroil him with women, whatever he meant by that. And then gradually he came out of it. But people have argued for centuries about what exactly happened and what caused it. People have said maybe it was mercury poisoning. Samples of his hair have been tested. And he did have dangerously elevated levels of mercury in his blood from all of his crazy work on alchemy. People have Freudian theories, and I try not to go that way because it requires speculation, but there is certainly plenty of material there if you want to look for a psychoanalytic interpretation of Newton's personality and his breakdown. His father died before he was born, so he grew up a posthumous child. Then, when he was still an infant, his mother remarried but abandoned him, left him alone in a farmhouse with a grandmother because the new stepfather had no interest in a squalling baby. So we can only guess what kind of effect that sort of rejection, that sort of alienated upbringing had on a smart young kid. Then we can jump ahead and see a personality that was angry and pathologically alone and ruthless in conflict and unhappy in interactions with other people. And certainly any psychiatrist could come up with connections between those things. We know that that's not the model of a healthy formative childhood.
Well, he also seems to be someone who had obsessions. And I suppose for a scientist, that's a good thing. You really want to be driven to understand. And he seemed to be obsessed about various things. I mean, not just the science that we've been talking about, but also the alchemy. I mean, you make the point in your book that he didn't just dabble in alchemy. He was the premier alchemist of his age.
That's right. It was a real shock to people who subsequently worked through the millions of words of notes that he took. And alchemy was a clandestine thing. It involved secrecy by its very nature and meetings with shadowy people who were using pseudonyms. And Newton had a pseudonym for himself for his alchemical work. But I think it's exactly right to think in terms of obsessiveness and not to try and draw a line separating healthy obsessiveness with unhealthy obsessiveness. When he did his greatest work in mathematics, you have to see that it was a kind of passion, a kind of holding a problem in his head for extended periods of time in a way that seems to us mathematical mortals to be superhuman and required. Well, obsessiveness is the only word for it. He had to be obsessed or he couldn't have made the leaps that he made.
Where does Newton's faith in God fit into this whole enterprise?
For him, it was another integral part of the picture. There was no separation whatsoever between his views about God's role in the universe and his views of how the universe worked scientifically. Subsequently, we've divided these things, and not only have we divided them, but we blame Newton for, or we credit him, depending on our point of view, for creating a separation between religion and science. His science was so powerful that it succeeded in answering all sorts of questions that people used to have to resort to religious explanations for. But he didn't have the kind of famous or notorious conflict with the church that Galileo had in his run-in with the Inquisition. In England, things were different. Newton believed fervently in God, and he never subtracted that from his view of the universe.
But he did have some heretical religious beliefs. He did not think that Jesus was the Son of God.
That's right. His heresies, though, were in specific what we would think of as fine points of religion. He didn't believe in the doctrine of the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, all equal and divine. He believed in God the Father, authoritative and supreme, and he believed that Jesus was subordinate to God. And he believed this in part because he had done a lot of serious textual analysis.
So he was a serious biblical scholar.
Very serious. He knew as much about the history of the Bible as anyone alive in his time.
This is just incredible. This picture that you're drawing of this man, I mean, what he knew in all these different realms and in the Bible, all of his work in alchemy, not to mention what he did in physics and mathematics. I mean, this truly was a Renaissance man.
He was a very complex, rich, peculiar person who is very different from our image of him if our image is of a supreme rationalist, because that Newton was constructed later with the advantage of hindsight in a world where we already then believed the things that Newton had discovered. Newton didn't live in that world. He was not a Newtonian. He was a complicated thinker who saw the possibilities of chaos, who didn't think he had final answers, who believed that he was bequeathing, if anything, not a system of the world, but a set of problems for later generations to explore.
James Glick is the author of Isaac Newton. Steve Paulson spoke with him.